sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets have their first week down in a while. We're going to be talking about net neutrality with Ken Monahan from Bloomberg and that four-letter word, debt, with Rachel Cruz. You probably know her. She works with Dave Ramsey. Actually, it's his daughter. We have all this and much more on episode number 368 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, let's start the day with something that needs to be said, you need to hear, because it's important. Happy Father's Day. Happy Dad's Day to everybody out there. Hope you're enjoying your day with your family. I know that I have multiple things planned throughout the day and evening, so took some time out to put together our podcast for the week, number 368, for the middle of June 2014, and have some great guests lined up for today. We're going to talk about net neutrality, the whole idea of what is it, how does it affect us, maybe get some ideas on some stocks from Ken Monahan from Bloomberg. And we're going to talk to you about the whole idea of, well, finances and debt and what's good debt. Is there good debt? Is there bad debt? And get the insight from a great guest, an author, Dave Ramsey's daughter, Rachel Cruz. But before that, I just want to talk really quickly about what's going on in the markets. And I'll get right to our guests. But we did see that there was some concern, clearly, about what's going on in Iraq. We saw that oil did spike as high as about 107. 17 came from 107.50, 107.60, and that was on the back of the issue with relation to, hey, you know what, there's some uprisings happening in Iraq, and are we going in as the U.S. to defend? No troops on the ground, but maybe we'll do some other work and get the U.N. involved. Who knows what's going to happen here, but definitely a concerning matter in terms of the security of our energy resources, which really is the whole backdrop of why it's so important to have energy independence, right? I mean, that really just, I guess, sums this all up right here with that we haven't had a problem in a while. But what if there's a problem? What if something does happen to a major supplier of our energy resources? You may see that Tesla, some of the electric battery companies, get a boost from this. I don't know how long it's going to go on. If it is anything like we have seen in the last number of years, it's a flare-up and then it drops to nothing. I don't know. We'll see. Interesting note that we did see that on the heels of the Draghi drop, the ECB, when they moved the deposit rates to a negative, where deposits on placement at the ECB are now going to cost the banks money, $25 billion. $25 billion moved out of the coffers of the ECB that day. Actually, the day after, on the Wednesday. It was a couple days leading up to it, when I guess they knew what was going on here. $25 billion left the ECB, leaving only about $35 billion on deposit only, which I thought was kind of interesting. Otherwise, really, the news has been that we saw some merger and acquisition activity. It was very interesting last week. We did see, of course, that Priceline is buying OpenTable. That was about a 50% premium overall. Interesting, you'll see some of the other names in that space, maybe some of the second tiers. And that's kind of why Pandora's been holding up, even though there's some competition going on there. You know, maybe even I think that Angie's List is kind of, you know, going nowhere but down moving forward, but we'll see what happens there. I mean, you do have competition now from other companies in that as well. But let's get to our first guest. Great guy. And that is Ken Monahan, who is the Senior Policy Analyst at Bloomberg. I'm going to talk about a subject that's been popping up for years, but more recently has become even more pronounced in the news. It's called net neutrality. It deals with a lot of things related to things behind the scenes in the internet. So, Ken, how are you, buddy?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I thought we would start off with something very simple, maybe for you, which is, what is this whole net neutrality thing?
Sure. Well, it's the principle that internet service providers, your Comcast, your AT&T's, Time Warner Cables, Verizon, should treat all internet content equally. What this means is when they deliver content and apps or websites, regardless of the source, it should be delivered without any blocking or discrimination to the public. So there shouldn't be any kind of limitations on what's delivered and what's passed forward, if you will, to consumers.
So here I am. I have my iPhone. I have my my computers and all that. And how would I know? Is there any way for me to know if somehow I'm being treated unfairly? I mean, what would happen?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's maybe you're sitting at home on a Thursday night, or a Friday night, and you're looking to get onto your Netflix, and suddenly something is coming in slower than you expect or you think. And there's any number of reasons why that could be the case, but perhaps your ISP, your internet service provider, is reducing the speed of that because they don't want to allow the Netflix movies to go at their full speed. Maybe there's a reason for that, maybe not. That's just one indicator, but you don't even necessarily know that's what's going on. But that's one of those signs, if you will, or you're on your iPhone. You can't, some website won't open up for some reason, but other ones will go much quicker. I mean, that might be an indicator that there's some choice or some prioritization going on as far as which websites are able to deliver fast content or immediately opening up on your phone. That's the idea, is if it's not neutral or it's not completely equal, then there might be some differences in terms of what's being delivered to you as a consumer.
And the big issue is, number one, that a lot of us consumers don't have a choice, right? So if we have a particular contract with a provider, for example, for our smartphones, or at our house, a particular provider that we don't get a choice for the most part, everybody has a choice. You can get like Dish because you just stick that thing in the ground or DirecTV and you face it whatever direction. But other than that, when it comes to cable, and
right.
I mean, you can get a T1 line, I guess. But again, it's just whoever's out there. You know, the way I look at this and the way I think about the whole idea of the internet in terms of the back end is plumbing. That's how I think of it, right? Mm-hmm. So the way I guess that I try to explain it is, here's the deal. So there is a water facility somewhere that's providing me the water. And what happened, and that's equivalent to your bandwidth, we'll call it, the amount of stuff you can actually have in total, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And then I get a pipe, big old pipe that comes in down the street or down the city, and it comes down to the house, then it comes into the house, and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller in terms of how much potential flow. And obviously, if you have the opportunity to get the entire amount of possible flow, you get good pressure, right?
Right.
Now, what happens is that with the internet, it's the same concept. The question is not the flow in my house, the ability of me getting the water to the sink and out and then taking it. But mm-hmm. the question I think the net neutrality gets to is, well, are they allowing me, even with the big pipes, to get all the access to that water? Is that a good way of looking at it?
It is. And I think that one of the questions is, how big is the pipe? And is there enough content being delivered through those pipes? 10 years ago, we were all... 15 years ago, the concept of the internet was email, right? So, we had these old email accounts over this, this arcane, internet structure, and then we had Hotmail and then Gmail. And now it's about, fast forward to today, it's about Netflix and high-definition video, and this is taking up more and more bandwidth, right? So there's increasing pressure to increase those pipes that you describe, right? And right now there's this sense that, with higher and higher, gigabytes and the size of the delivery of this stuff, that it's creating pressure on those pipes and making it harder for people to get everything they want. So this is creating incentive, if you will, for companies like Comcast or AT&T to prioritize and say, okay, if you want to get that content, you, either the consumer or the content provider like a Netflix or Amazon, has to pay a little bit more to get that. So that's kind of getting the idea that there's scarcity, if you will, right? So if you flip this on its head and say, well, there might be other ways to increase broadband. So you have Google Fiber is moving into cities. You have AT&T and others who are investing in these really awesome high speed networks, right, and giving people alternatives. Then it does two things. It creates more competition at the consumer level, at least in terms of their options. I mean, Andrew, you talked about how you only have one choice often, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also it creates the competition, so the Comcast keeps them on their toes. Number two is that these are really big pipes that these companies are delivering these communities. And so it actually might almost make this whole net neutrality debate maybe not obsolete, but less poignant, right? Because you now have less scarcity, right? Because it's just the pipes are a lot bigger. So you get Netflix, sure, and then you can get so much more, and there's not this pressure or this question about choosing one or the other or having to pay more. So by doing that, maybe it creates or changes the economics such that Comcast doesn't really, they can't charge more for something because There's no need to. There's no scarcity. And that, I think that's a looking a little bit longer view, but I think we are where we are right now because there's been so much content being pushed on the internet, and to all of our benefit, we're getting a lot more, you know, videos and the ability to do different things on Facebook. But that is because I don't think that necessarily the infrastructure and the pipes have quite caught up with where the demand, if you will, supply and demand. There's not enough, maybe not enough bandwidth to get everything to us that we need. And so the ISPs, the Comcast, are going to say, well, you know, we should be able to charge a little bit more to get some things to you because you want it, and that's taking up a lot of the flow of into your house through those pipes that you described. I don't know if that's where it's going to go, but yeah.
Yeah, but I have a question. So
yeah.
It currently is, quote unquote, as far as I know, it's legal to have different plans. So for example, I can have, I really want a fast internet. So I'm going to go for the Big Daddy plan, and I'm going to have, you know, open this, you know, I'm going to get, you know, 50 gigabyte down, I'm going to get gigabit, I'm going to get 25 up, and if for some reason they always limit the upside. It's always it's not always equal. And I'm going to pay, I'm just, you know, picking some numbers, $100 a month.
Sure.
You know, on the other hand, maybe somewhere else, maybe my vacation home, maybe next door, let's say, same everything, you know, just next door. I don't need that much. I'm going to take five. I'm going to take the minimum. Now, they can charge different rates in that scenario, right? Because that's my choice. Is that what, but what he's saying is that where does the problem come in?
Well, the problem comes in when, okay, so at the consumer level, you're absolutely right. It's legal. They can set different levels. You can, you know, throttle up, throttle down. You can decide what you want and pay for that. That's all fine. And that's the individual consumer decides. They know going in, I'm going to pay more for more because I need more or I want more. That's okay. The problem comes in where, okay, you've agreed to this, you know, this much, you know, either you get X speed or Y speed or Z speed, whatever it might be. And then suddenly they're saying, well, your delivery of Netflix is going to be slower. They're not saying that like a high quality consumer is going to get Netflix at this speed or the other one. I mean, you are to some degree, if you are paying for a faster speed, you can get it quicker. But the fact that Netflix is going to suddenly, for all of its consumers or all of the people who are Netflix subscribers, aren't going to get it as fast or as quick because AT&T or Comcast or one of these companies is saying, well, we're not going to let you, you know, do that unless you pay. It's a little bit convoluted because yes, you're paying for more, you know, faster service, but at the same time, you're not going to get that service as fast as you think you should. And that's where this gets a little bit touchy. And furthermore, it gets into the issue of innovation. Excuse me. And then you get companies who are, you know, startups and saying, well, we want to be the next Netflix or the next Google. And if the Googles and the Amazons can pay for, you know, faster delivery of the content to the consumer, irrespective of how fast they're paying for their plan, we're not going to be able to compete with those guys. So in other words, we're stuck as consumers with Google. We're stuck with Netflix. Right. We're stuck with Amazon. We don't have any choice. And that, I think that is for the folks in, you know, the IT community and Silicon Valley who are really pushing, you know, hard against these rules. Or, you know, the changes to the neutrality rules are saying, well, hold on here. This is going to change the innovation. This is going to change the culture of the internet in a fundamental way. And so that's kind of what's different. And that's what's the concern I think people have right now.
And so where is government on this? What is the whole, where are we now? Because I know this is sparking up pretty well in this.
Right.
You know, we've had the FCC involved in all this and net neutrality came up. It was a big thing. And then nothing because they couldn't, whatever. But now there's some wrinkle in all this, right?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, so a brief history. I mean, we could talk for hours about the details and the arcane details of the arguments and the court cases and the rest of it. But really, three dates to keep in mind. So, 2005, the FCC comes in and makes an initial push to address net neutrality. Okay, you know, lay out some broad principles that are important for the web in terms of openness. That's that. December 2010, and to be clear, the Federal Communications Commission is the agency that regulates, you know, telecom services and the internet and broadband and others. So the 2010, they come in with this what's called an open internet order, and they expand the rules, particularly as saying no discrimination that's unreasonable, no blocking of content, and transparency. So this is a big deal, and then they're making this big push to trying to codify these rules. Well, instantly there's a court case. Verizon files a case against the FCC. In January of this year, you've got the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit saying that the 2010 Open Internet Order is largely invalid, and this throws everything into disarray. So basically, the upshot of all this is that the government, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, has to come up with new rules that are consistent with the January court decision. All right, and yet they still want to encourage the open internet and net neutrality. And so there's this kind of threading this needle, and this is a huge priority of President Obama in 2008 when he campaigned in his first election. And yet you can't, the sense, at least within the, you know, Chairman Tom Wheeler at the commission at the FCC, that you can't you don't want to open up more litigation and more lawsuits in the future. So they're stuck. Okay, so they're trying to open, you know, again, encourage the internet and yet do it in a lawful way. And that's where we are right now, and this is why this is taking up such a brouhaha, because Wheeler's trying to put forward a proposal which will kind of thread the needle, if you will, like I was saying. And bottom line, the upshot is that his proposal would allow what are called fast lanes. So, you know, for the ISPs to say, okay, we're going to deliver internet faster for certain content if we want to. And that's exactly what they've been looking to do in these court challenges, in these cases.
You know, I got to tell you something. It's interesting because it would seem logical that if we have a pay-to-play concept, right?
Right,
so, which is a phraseology that's used in this whole thing,
sure,
of net neutrality, where, you know, a bit, just if you could do such a thing, right? Bit is a penny. Well, which is ridiculous, but just saying, a bit is a penny. And if you flow this much through, then you're going to pay that much. Now, the question is, who pays, first of all, right? Is it going to be the provider or the consumer, the consumption of that data, or a shared situation? You know, if I am sitting there and I am a, for example, if I am an institute, this kind of different, this is very, let's be honest, it's very complicated, okay? Because it's like you could keep on throwing all sorts of different things here. For example, I'm a consumer, I'm an individual. Let's say that all day long I'm just watching movies. High def or 400 or the 4,000 level, you know, that kind of stuff. And I'm just like sucking the death out of, you know, this thing. Okay, that's one thing. Second thing is, well, what if I'm not a consumer, but I'm a business and I'm in the movie business? You know, do I pay the same amount there? I mean, I don't know. You know, that's a commercial use of it. So there's things like that. Then there's, on the other hand, there's, okay, well, I'm an individual and I'm using the same amount of bandwidth, but I'm not using it for, let's say, video, but I'm using it for, I don't know why, data flow, which is a lot, of course.
Right.
I mean, how do we differentiate with all of this, and how do we come up with who, what, who's going to pay for it? Is it because, you know, that Netflix, example, Netflix has movies, it's a streaming situation, Apple, et cetera, or is it going to be, for example, if it's an iMessage kind of concept, or Facebook, because a lot of videos and things play on there? And,
yeah.
I mean, this is so complex, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think there's, you know, and I'm certainly not one to advocate, you know, one position over another, but I think, you know, you can, you know, you've been seeing a fair amount about data capping. You know, certainly some of the ISPs have put forward, you know, proposals and where, you know, certain consumers would pay more if they use more data. I mean, think about it as your cell phone, and increasingly you go to a 4G network, you know, an LTE phone in Verizon, now you're capped in terms of your data. I mean, you're not limited beyond that level, but you have to pay to get more data. So that's one thing that, you know, people who are heavy users can pay more. It puts an economic cost on consumers who are going to be using more. That's anathema to many who don't agree with that concept, but that's one way in which you can address some of those concerns, if you think that is an issue or a problem, if the data really is so expensive that they need to, you know, the ISPs need to charge more in order to you know, maintain their profitability or whatever it would be. Although I'd argue they're already doing quite well, but that is certainly, you know, one way in which you can get at that. You know, or, you know, Netflix could, or an Amazon could charge more for some of it. Their high volume, you know, consumers right now, you pay whatever, $8, $9 a month for unlimited, movies. Right. So, I mean, I don't watch that. I mean, I watch probably a few movies or TV shows a month. You know, it's worth it for us, for my wife and I, but we don't really watch so much that, you know, we're certainly throttling the system, whereas others, you know, are sitting on their couch all day. Maybe those people should be paying, you know, more or something like that for what they're using versus less. I mean, that's one way in which the content providers can pass along some of that cost down to the consumers. I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing, but that's certainly ways in which you can differentiate the pricing in a way that, you know, people who are using more for data flows, as you say, or watching movies or whatever it might be, pay for what they're getting. And that's, I think that's, you know, one way in which you can do it. And this is, again, assuming that it really is a problem, that there's so much. I mean, we talked about the price example earlier. I mean, this is assuming that there really is an issue and a scarcity problem out there. If there is, and there's a need, and there's the cable companies or the broadband companies can, you know, charge more and get away with it, then that's one way in which you can do that. Or if the Netflixes can increase their revenue by charging certain consumers more, you know, one would think they would want to do that. I'm not saying they want.
So how do we know if there's scarcity?
Well,
it's kind of like air, right? Maybe we're running out of air. Maybe we're not. I mean, and somebody's going to say, well, you know what, you need to stop utilizing, you know, all the air. And it's like a global warming thing, it seems like to me. You know what I mean? It's like, it can't be proved.
If you know, if you're watching a movie at night, and you don't really know necessarily anything, but you see, you know, that the hourglass or the, you know, circling spinning on your computer when you're trying to, or TV when you're trying to stream, you know, a baseball, you know, game on an MLB TV or Netflix. I mean, you know that there's something going on. Okay, now do you know that is because your connection is slow? Is because
you have no idea. Let's be honest, you have no idea.
You don't know exactly where the source of that is at that point in time. You might be able to say it's one of the three or four things, right? It could be my cable connection is not that great at my house, let's say. So therefore, it's a break in the service, and it has nothing to do with, you know, net neutrality or anything else. Or it could be in the pipes deep in the internet, you know, a dispute between the content provider and the Comcast. Who knows? I mean, that's one of the things where you don't know really what is going on behind there as a consumer at the last.
I mean, I sometimes have planes flying over. I'm not even kidding about this. I swear. I have planes fly over, and I notice there's something like all of a sudden things slow down. I'm thinking, what is that about?
Right.
I know that sounds ridiculous, but I'm telling you, it happens all the time. And I'm like, well, maybe it's some kind of dish that they got going on and something around, you know, and you're right about that. You know, you don't know, because maybe it has to do with simply that if I'm on cable, my whole block has cable, the guy next door all of a sudden started just, you know, every single computer in his house is running movies all of a sudden. And you don't know if, you know, you all of a sudden got, because you don't got a direct pipe into the main line, if you will. You know, you kind of got it degrades over time. What is this whole approach about this reclassification of broadband into the common carrier alternatives? Mm-hmm.
What is it, or what is it, or what, in terms of what?
Tell me, what's the deal?
Well, a couple things. I mean, well, basically, if you, going back to that January court decision, where basically, you know, for the one of the ways in which the FCC can reclassify broadband is they can say it's a communication service. It's like, you know, like the phones, essentially, and it would be broadband. Would be regulated that way, and such that there will be hard and fast rules on what companies can do and how they can provide their service, and that they're not allowed to discriminate. It is considered to be a drastic step, if you will, that the FCC would take, and it's unpopular, certainly among Republicans, and who will say, you know, kind of verbatim, will say, well, these are the 1930s, you know, a monopoly, anti-monopoly rules. We're not dealing with a monopoly environment. This is inappropriate. It's a bludgeon, if you will, you know, to use that measure. Democrats, I think, generally, although there's some openness among some, are also concerned about taking that step because they think it might be too dramatic. But it is one way. The court has said if the FCC wants to go ahead and do that, then they would have the ability to do that if they can, you know, go ahead and pass that and regulate the internet that in a way that would be far more. In other words, they have the authority to do that if they want to.
Is there any clear violations that we know about? I mean, you know, listen, I'm sure they can be tricky with this whole thing. You know, a little bit. If Amazon and Rackspace and all these guys can put up servers and you can utilize all these servers, because we just went through this, like, okay, what do we want to do about servers and things like that for streaming, some of the stuff we do? And, you know, they can basically take this block and this whole grouping of servers and essentially rent out bandwidth space on a per, like, measure. So, like, as you're ramping up, all of a sudden you take a little bit from over there, a little bit from over here, and you don't. It's all behind the scenes. You don't know what's going on. You kind of expand and contract your broadband as needed, right? And it's not because you're on one server. It's that kind of you're sharing this whole big old picture. And if that can be done, I would venture to say that, you know, obviously the ISPs are smart enough and they have some kind of technology. Somebody created something that allows them to pass through what they need at any given time. But has there been any clear proof anywhere that somebody's saying, hey, you know what, this neighborhood, this person, this business is, aside from the Netflix issue, of course,
right,
that you know, ISPs are doing this kind of stuff? And if they are, has it been detrimental? That's the big issue, right? Because who cares if it's what? Who cares if 4 a.m. they shut me down in terms of availability? And I'm, you know, until I need it. But, you know, is there anything that's been shown that is actually causing harm?
I don't think, and I think that's the argument that the ISPs will make. Because there is, you know, show us that evidence. You know, Netflix is trying to say, well, we're seeing a slowing of speeds. You know, they've been posting in the last few weeks. There's been these alerts saying, oh, this is because, you know, Comcast or your ISP is lowering your service. But the ISPs will come back to you and say, well, we don't have the evidence of that. So show us what we're doing. And furthermore, these companies are on the record as saying we're not going to we're going to adhere to, not all of them, of course, I mean, but Comcast is required. When they bought NBC Universal a few years ago, they were required to uphold net neutrality rules through 2017, okay? AT&T, I was just listening to an event at the Aspen Institute yesterday in Washington. AT&T's rep here in Washington said, you know, we have no intention of going against net neutrality rules, as it were. And so it's a question of what exactly they'll do. And if to this point that you've seen a change, I don't think we've seen changes since January, but the court decision. But I think we will, you know, over time, business models will evolve. And if there's, getting back to our earlier conversation about the pipes and the scarcity, if they feel like there's the ability to do so and to monetize, they certainly think they will.
Well, that's the point. That's the point, my friend.
Yes,
you just hit the whole thing right there.
Right.
All of this is great discussion. At the end of the day, is how are they going to pick the pockets of whoever they can pick?
Or
that's the bottom line.
The argument also is that they, you know, again, this just gets back to your question: what's behind the wall, and what is where is their scarcity? But the companies will say that, you know, the benefit of that monetization is that puts more money back into investment to build out the networks and provide faster connections and the rest of it. I mean, that's
spinach; it's good for you.
Right. No, I mean, and I think that we're, you know, and I'm certainly, again, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that one's better than the other, but I think that is, you know, they will try to make money off of what they can and boost the revenue as any, you know, well-respecting company will try to do. And
right.
then the question is going to be what will the market bear? And I think, well, you know, if they do, let's play this out. If they do that and there's, you know, let's say that the cost of delivering this content goes up, you know, measurably because of these deals, if they are, you know, these prioritization deals do happen, then you know consumers can, maybe they'll look for alternatives. Now I only have one, you know, ISP, you know, or one option in my house. Okay, I've got different options for cable and for satellite TV, but I only have one option for broadband. That's a problem for me because I don't have an alternative. But, you know, maybe over time wireless becomes a better alternative. You know, there's been talk about this Wi-Fi hotspots, or we know the Wi-Fi. You know, there'll be more opportunities for other ways to get. Certainly, maybe Google moves into my neighborhood, and, you know, with the fiber network. So there, I think that the market will, you know, one hopes, you know, it will react to that if there is, you know, an imbalance, or if, you know, the costs are going up in a way that, you know, will counter monopolistic type activity, if you will.
Right.
And so I think that's where, you know, that's where your earlier question, I think, you know, you hit it as well in saying, you know, is there scarcity? Well, we don't know in some ways, but we may know that we see prices going up, and that there's, you know, others will come in and say, okay, well, there's got to be a way for us to get into this market and siphon off some of that revenue, because clearly there's more, you know, this is not a free market, or the equilibrium is off. You know, the meeting point of the demand curve and the supply curve isn't quite where it should be. So that's where I think we could see, you know, alternatives move in, and that'll be really interesting to see, you know, over the next few years.
I guess the other thing is, you ever see the movie Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger, the
sure.
original one?
Yeah.
And remember, he went to Mars, right?
Of course.
And he went to Mars, and there was that guy that controlled the air. Remember
right.
that, the, you know, and this was the guy that controlled everything, because if he controlled the air, I mean, obviously, you know, you don't want to mess with this guy, right? It's kind of like we're having the air controlled, because really, what is the internet, right? You know, I mean, of course, we know that, you know, this was created back in, I don't know, whatever, you know, 50 years ago for military, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like an opening, and it's a connectivity issue. It's just connections mm-hmm. of all this, and really, what is the cost of it? It's not like there's a limit to this. It's not, you know, it technically is unlimited, because there is nothing. It's just, you know, the excess of this. But it's kind of interesting, I guess. The whole point is, you want to think that the government is for the consumer here, obviously. You know, that's the, you know, because we can't fight our own battle on this, right? So the government is for the consumer on this. And if, in fact, the government has a play in this and they're going to be the final word, I will tell you, the end of the day, there's not going to be anything done with this for a while. That's my opinion. There's such roadblock, logjam in government right now, especially with the Eric Cantor loss recently, and the whole thought that Tea Party may be taking over. I don't think anything's going to budge out of here for the next year and a half.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, on that, I think that there is the FCC says that they're going to pass their new rules this year. Okay,
mm-hmm. Right.
And that action happens independent of Congress. So we can for now, and I can loop back Congress in a minute, because I think it is very important what happens there for net neutrality going forward, irrespective of what the FCC does this year. Okay, but the FCC is going to, they've got a public comment period out right now where the public is, I think it's like 300,000 comments. I mean, it's I think their second greatest hit. I was reading something that it was, I think it's their second biggest issue that's gotten of public attention, you know, in its history. So it's,
first one has to be like curse words. It has to.
No,
be.
It was. I think it was that Super Bowl, the infamous Super Bowl incident a couple of years ago.
That was great. Oh, Janet Jackson.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That one apparently got over 500,000 hits or comments. So we'll be watching with bated breath to see if net neutrality can beat out Janet Jackson, but the question there is going to be, so you got these public comments, you've got these issues we touched on a little bit earlier about whether they're going to reclassify as a common carrier or whether the preferred approach, certainly amongst the commission, and Tom Wheeler, the chairman, is to kind of fudge things and go with the current law and use existing authority to regulate. Now, if they can do that this year, that they'll try to do that. Now, there's no guarantee, irrespective of what the FCC does, there won't be more litigation. I've argued in my writing that there will be probably risk to litigation no matter what they do. Okay, that's the first thing. But the bottom line is they'll try to get some rules done this year. Now, right now you've got a split in Congress. So you've got the Democrats control the Senate, the Republicans in the House. We know President Obama is for net neutrality. That's a given. But Republicans don't want this. They don't want any regulation. They don't want neutrality. Throw it all out. The Democrats want it. So if you see the Republicans take over the Senate this year, you might see new legislation as early as next year, seeking to strip FCC authority or trying to make it a lot harder for them to regulate net neutrality and could try to undo what they've done this year. Okay, that's a possibility. Okay. Again, you've got President Obama in office, and so there's going to be pressure, against, Congress from doing that, and he certainly would be in a position to veto that. But that will be, and this isn't over no matter, and by any means, even if the FCC does, vote on something this year. And I think that the chances are that they probably will. But the future is uncertain between litigation and future legislation either way, however this plays out this year.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for this education on all this. We really never talked about this before. Ken Monahan over at Bloomberg. You can take a look at him. We're going to have some information on some of his articles that he writes, some of the things that you can find on the quote-unquote retail side of Bloomberg. And I want to thank so much for helping us out today.
Great, Andrew. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ken. Bye-bye. Take care. Okay, with our second guest, Rachel Cruz, the author of Smart Money, Smart Kids. And we're going to talk about something that needs to be talked about, and it's the whole idea of what's going on in the world of credit and loans and, what do we do all about it. So, Rachel, how are you?
Hey, doing well. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to talk about a lot of things that deal with the whole idea of, we hear from the world that, hey, consumer credit is up, $20 billion this month, and that's a good thing. And on the other hand, we hear, you don't want to get yourself in hot water, and our kids are getting mixed messages. We had the advent of, getting credit at an early... Listen, when I was young, I'm a little bit older than you, but nonetheless, when I was young, the first thing I was told when I turned 18, it was, you go get yourself a Sears credit card, and you start developing credit, and you start getting your credit history right, and then you get these other credits. And then all of a sudden, only a few years later, honestly, all of a sudden, I was inundated with credit cards, right? And, they just give you all sorts of amounts that you can use, and it seems like free money. And then, you start paying the minimums and all that, and you get yourself into a heap of trouble. So kind of like going back a number of years to today, what's been going on in the whole world of credit? What's changed, and kind of what's your insight about this?
Well, the credit card industry, I believe, are probably the most sophisticated marketers on the planet. They have convinced the American people that you cannot live life without a credit card, that you must have a credit card to survive in America today. And a lot of that goes exactly to what you're talking about, is this idea of building your credit score and establishing credit, your FICO score. And I even, when I was a freshman in college, this was, obviously years back, but I remember my professor standing at the front of the room. It was like in a big lecture hall. It was my econ 101 class. And he stood in front of, 400 college students and told all of us, go sign up for a credit card and just buy gas on it or socks or something that you can pay off because you want to start building that credit. You don't want to graduate college without a credit score. And I grew up as Dave Ramsey's kid. Dave Ramsey's my dad. And so the whole idea of no debt was drilled into our minds since I can remember. So I thought, I had no clue really what a credit score was. Mom and Dad honestly didn't really talk to us about it. They may have mentioned it, but I didn't know about it very well. So I went back to my dorm room and Googled and called my dad, and I was like, what is this thing? And so it's amazing, this myth that if you don't have a credit score or a credit card that you can't survive in America today. It's just false, because really you're going into debt and staying in debt to get a score to go into more debt. You know, that's what the credit score is for.
Right.
So it's just, it's crazy. So that is a myth that people believe. You can live life without a credit score. You can live life without a credit card. And I'm living proof of that.
You know, it's interesting because, again, years ago, it was like, okay, I'm going to get a house, something I can afford. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to pay it off. I'm going to have no mortgage eventually because, you know, obviously certain things, you can't just come up with a heap of cash to buy, right?
Sure.
I mean, you know, and these days it looks like what happened, and one of the big reasons that we had the financial fallout in the mid-2000s there was all about how, hey, you know what? We think you're going to buy this property, go well above your means, because housing always goes up, you know, go well above your means, and then when it goes up, even take more money out of it and all. So, you know, are we ever, though, going to have a time, because it doesn't seem like it's even after that sunk in, that we live within our means in terms of, I'm talking about housing now, you're still reaching for the stars in getting, you know, really expensive property well above your means. I mean, my daughter just moved into her first apartment in New York, just graduated from graduate school over Columbia, and she's got an apartment.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Now, the good news and bad news. The bad news is she wants to live in Manhattan. She's got an apartment, very small. It's not even an apartment. It's kind of a door with an opening. and it's $1,800 a month. Now, when you kind of calculate this all out and you kind of try to be logical about this financially, it's about, after taxes, after that, it's like 40% of her income goes to that. It's absurd.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, she picked one of the most expensive places on the planet to live, there in Manhattan.
Right.
I mean, that's, absolutely. The pricing is ridiculous there, obviously. But yeah, we I think that's just what you were talking about. It's just kind of this bigger and better, and that even if we can't afford it, we can afford the payment. And that's kind of where Americans have gotten this idea that I can afford it if I can afford the monthly payment.
Right.
And it's gotten people in trouble, and they're living way above their means. And they're in debt. And what people don't realize is that you're doing this, yes, debt steals your income from you. Debt is like a thief. I mean, it steals your income from you, but not just your income and the mathematics of it, but it's also your peace of mind. I mean, debt is such a burden for so many people, and it stresses you out, it freaks you out. You know you have to owe someone something at the end of the month, and it just, there's so much entanglement, and it's just hopeless is what it feels like to a lot of people. And so this idea that, I'm going to look really good at the stoplight, you know, in my nice car that I'm paying, you know, $400 a month for that I really can't afford, but I look good, and that's what's important. It's amazing that we've gotten to this place in America today where that's the priority over common sense ways of living. If you don't have the money, don't buy it.
Yeah, live within the means. You know, it's fun. This is a true story. I'm not kidding. I'm not just making it up because I'm talking to you. I was in Publix today this morning. And I was walking down the dairy aisle, and there was these people stocking the shelves, you know, the people that work there, at the supermarket.
Sure.
And I overheard, because I couldn't help it. I was the only one, and these other two people there, and they're talking, and it says, you know what, that's the last time I paid that kind of money for a car. And all right, I'm getting my little few things and all that. And I hear the other guy say, well, what did you get, and how much did you pay? And she says, well, it cost me $47 for this truck she bought or something. $47,000. I'm thinking to myself, well, maybe she's wealthy. I don't know. I can't count somebody else's money, right?
Right.
I don't know. What do I know? You know, and I've been thinking to myself, well, she's working in Publix, stocking the shelves. Something doesn't fit right with me. Now, is there something changing, or is this just an educational process? Because I don't think I don't see it changing. Honestly, I just don't see, you know, this whole process of just buying whatever because it is made easy in terms of credit. You know, hey, buy now, don't pay for anything for 24 months. And you can buy $5,000 worth of furniture that you can't afford. You wouldn't be able to afford it otherwise, right? Don't pay anything for 24 months, and then you got to pay some god-awful amount on the back end that you're going to pay off for the next 10 years. It sounds great, right? But what's the problem with that?
Oh, gosh. Well, what happens is you end up living paycheck to paycheck. According to the Wall Street Journal, 70% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. You don't have margin with your life. And the emotional toll that it takes, I mean, it's just, it's horrible. In the line of work I'm in, you know, I hear countless stories of the both the good and the bad, but also the ones, you know, where families are saying, parents are saying, adults are saying, how did we get ourselves in this mess? And I think it's this lie that our generation has believed that debt has to be a part of your life, and we've accepted that. So we said, okay, well, we have to have a credit card. So you just go and, but I'm doing it for the airline miles and the Discover points, you know. So you do that, and then you go get two car loans because, well, you know, you're always going to have a car payment. You're always going to have a car payment. So go get a nice car, you know. So, you know, you go get that $47,000 truck that you can't afford. Right. And then, of course, you can't be a student without a student loan. Everyone knows that, right? So that's another lie out there. You go get a student loan, and then you get married. You go buy a house you can't afford because everyone's saying, you know, you're renting. You can't rent. Renters go to hell. Don't rent. You need to buy. You need to buy. Buy something now. And then this young couple, you know, that has no money, deeply in debt, goes and gets a mortgage on top of that with nothing down, you know, because that's what you're able to get. I mean, it's crazy how we've
So how do you start, though? But how do you start? I mean, listen, so I want a car. Okay, so let's just say there's good credit and bad credit. I'm not going off the deep end saying that you can't ever use credit for certain things, but I mean, you know, there's certain, would you agree with that, or we're saying absolutely no credit ever?
I say no debt at all except a mortgage.
Okay, except a mortgage, and not even a car.
Oh, nope, but not
you,
a car.
In other words, you'd buy a car. In other words, not would you pay off a car? I mean, what do you do with that?
Well, if you have debt, so if you have the car loan, if you have the student loan, the credit card, I teach people to get out of debt and stay out of debt. According to Thomas Stanley's book, The Millionaire Next Door, where he went and studied millionaires, it's a great book, a great, great book, because he talks about how America's broke, and actually the people that are winning in life don't care what you think. So they don't look like millionaires, but they're actually the ones that have money left over and are able to invest and et cetera, et cetera. But 78% of millionaires today say the number one key of building wealth is getting out of debt and staying out of debt.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because your largest wealth-building tool is your income. And when your income comes in and it doesn't go back out 18 different directions, it's yours. You don't owe anyone anything. Your income is yours. That's where you can save and invest and give. That's how you're able to build wealth. So my goal for people is to get out of debt. And the most effective way to do that is you're going to list out all of your debts, except for your mortgage, list out all of your debts, smallest to largest, regardless of the interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
Pay minimum payments on everything and attack that smallest debt first. Once that's paid off, take that minimum payment you were paying on that, roll it over to the second smallest debt. Pay that off. When you get to the third smallest debt, you have, you know, the minimum payment from the first and second debt on top of the third minimum payment on that third smallest debt. You pay that off, and you make sacrifices in your lifestyle. You don't go out to eat.
Wait,
you have
sacrifices? Wait a minute. Whoa.
Best word today, isn't it? Yeah.
What do you mean sacrifices?
Yeah. That's right. Well, sacrificing your lifestyle. Cut the cable. I mean, and maybe your car loan. Maybe you sell the car. And, you know, you make these crazy sacrifices because we're seeing on average families are getting completely out of debt except for their house in 18 to 24 months.
Wow.
And it's amazing because the human spirit, once you start paying off debt, even if your first debt, your smallest debt is a $800 Macy's card, you know, say it's something small, but you decide, okay, we're going to do this. You pull $800 together and you pay it off, and it's like, okay, we can do this. Then you roll it over to the second smallest debt, and it's amazing, the human spirit, how motivated you get. And people, and they're freed up, and this freedom, again, isn't just financial or mathematical. It's emotional and spiritual.
Yeah.
When you don't owe someone something, you can breathe. You can go to sleep at night and rest easy.
You know, it's kind of like a diet. Seriously. I mean, you know, the hardest thing is that Monday comes and I'm doing it on Monday. And you just, you know, just cut out the crackers. Just cut out the bread or whatever it is that you're doing. Seriously. And then it kind of just, it's a process, I guess. So
yes.
What's going on with student loans? I mean, I think we're getting a bit of a mixed message. Okay. So on one hand, again, I'm a bit older than you, okay? I'm 49, let's just say that, okay? I'm approaching more than 49. I'm 49, okay? So you didn't have to say that, okay? But no, so I'm 49 years old, okay? And now, again, I remember that, you know, college education was important, but these days, it's not just important. It's at least what's being drilled in everybody's heads, and I'm not disagreeing with this, that it is absolute. You have a college education, you won't get a job otherwise. So now, college costs have gone up pretty substantially. Now, assume you don't have your parents paying for it or some other kind of tuition grant of some sort, or, you know, what do you do about that? How do you go about that?
Sure. Well, the very first thing you want to do is you want to make a smart choice on where you go to school. This is the biggest mistake people make. They have champagne tastes and beer wallets. I mean, you know, you have to go to a school you can afford. And for a lot of students, that means staying in state, taking in-state tuition, and the average in-state school is running about $9,000 a year. So that's $4,500 a semester. You know, right above $4,000. To stay in-state, take in-state tuition, or even go to a community college for the first year or two. You know, those first 2 years of college, it's your prereqs for the most part.
Right.
And if you go to a community college close to a state school, which the majority of the time they're partnering together as your credits will transfer. But that's the key, is going to choosing that school you can afford, and then scholarships and grants. This is free money, and there are literally hundreds of thousands of scholarships out there. So go and find them. Google, talk to people, apply for these scholarships. And the mistake students make is they say, you know, Rachel, most of the scholarships, you know, it's just $200. That's a drop in the bucket to my tuition. But I tell them, if you fill out that form and you write that essay and it takes you 30 minutes and you get that scholarship, you just make $200 in 30 minutes.
Right.
If you made that your part-time job, you could get your way through school if you just decided to dedicate to that. I was talking to a girl in Texas, and she said she came from a single mom, and her mom said her junior year of high school, I'm not going to be able to pay a cent for your college tuition. I can't give you a penny. So you're going to have to figure it out. So she made her Christmas break of her senior year of high school apply for 2 scholarships a day.
Wow.
She came home and she had to do 2 a day. And she said, I got denied by a lot. I had to find the most obscure scholarships because I just had to find something to fill out this form. And she just through perseverance and doing it, she had 3 years of her school paid for through scholarships. She worked those 3 years, saved up the cash, and cash flowed her 4th year.
And she paid for it herself, and then she got out and she didn't have any debt.
Exactly. Yes. It's amazing.
On the college,
and then also working, which is, you know, child abuse to some people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. But working your way through school, research has shown us that the average college student works 20 hours a week. They can pay their way through an in-state school just by working. I mean, that's babysitting. If you make $12 an hour for 20 hours a week, that's right around $4,500. And so it's amazing what you can do by just being intentional. And so, but if you believe the lie that you can't go to school without a student loan, it's much easier to sign your name to that document and not worry about it for 4.5 years. But it takes a lot of work, a lot of dedication, a lot of sacrifice to do it my way. But if you could imagine graduating without, now the average is $33,000 in debt and student loans, where you don't have to pay that back. And over time, that ends up turning into around $48,000 because of interest. I mean, you get to avoid all of that because you've sacrificed. If you'll sacrifice and work your butt off for 4 years of your life, then you'll have the next 20 years of your life not having to pay back loans.
Isn't that interesting? Because, I mean, that's something that I brought up to my kids. I said, listen, you just get through this time period and, yeah, sacrifice or, you know, do what you got to do. Go with the program. Just comply is what I say. And you know what? Then you got all this time ahead of you that's going to be a breeze. But you know what? It's going to be hard now. It's so hard for a lot of us. I mean, any of us. Come on, let's be honest. To take that sacrifice now, whatever it may be, whether it's not having the car, whether it's not having, you know, all the furniture that you want, the brand new furniture, et cetera. When, though, I know you're about the younger times in life and educating early. When's early enough for those parents listening out there? When should they start kind of doing their best, even if they don't do it, by the way, educating their kids about this?
I say the earlier the better. I mean, you can start even as early as 4 years old. And when you teach kids about money, it's very age-appropriate, very age-appropriate. So, you know, growing up as Dave Ramsey's kid, for instance, we were never given an allowance. We were always on commission.
Ah,
so
nice.
You work, you get paid. You don't work, you don't get paid. And so even things like that, have a little chore chart on your refrigerator and don't just hand your kids a dollar every time they ask. Let them do something to earn the money because you're making a work-money connection. The money comes from work. Money doesn't come from mom and dad's back pocket. And just that simple life lesson, I mean, what a beautiful gift to give your kids, because there's a generation that there's a disconnect with how much work has to go into making money. They don't realize it, but if you can teach your kids even that, I mean, you know, they're probably far ahead than most kids their age. So finding things like that and teaching them to give and save and spend. And so, again, it's very age-appropriate. It's not this big mutual fund discussion with your 5-year-old. But find teachable moments throughout the day. And it's amazing. Common sense ways of living with money. It's the same if you're 15 or if you're 55. And so just, you know, talk to your kids about it and be that example. But you're not going to be perfect, because some parents are like, no, we're the ones with the furniture we can't afford and the car loan and all that. But if you're not perfect with money, you don't lose your parenting card. You know, you still have the right to parent.
Right.
So and it's interesting. Even if you're not perfect, do it.
So you know, it's kind of, I'm assuming, I'm making an assumption, you know, when you're young and you're going through this as Dave Ramsey's kid or whoever it may be, and, you know, you're saying, hey, you have to do this or else you're not getting paid. You're not probably as a kid thinking, oh, wow, this is a great education for my future. You know, you're thinking, this sucks. I don't, my friend over there, he's just hanging out and he gets his nice allowance. He doesn't do anything at all. But at the end of the day, it's like with my kids, I said, here's the deal. My wife's big on just taking care of the kids and doing whatever. And I said, there's one thing I will just forbid. They are going to pay for any car that they want. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to require, I should say. And, you know, my son came to me, my daughter came to me afterwards and said, you know, Dad, I feel so good because this is mine.
Yeah.
It's mine. I mean, you know, whether or not they, you know, help them out with a payment here or there or something of that nature, maybe the insurance, but it's mine. And I feel like all these other friends of mine have these cars and things that were given to them by their parents. And again, just one little point kind of gives them that insight about how important it is to have something that's yours and how to teach them to appreciate the work that they did to actually get something, that it is not an entitlement. You know, listen, I don't know about you, but this whole millennial generation and whatever you want to call them, there's a lot of entitlement that's going around, right?
Oh, 100%, yes. And I think a way to break that, because entitlement, there's kind of a sense of arrogance about it. You know, that I deserve this. I deserve the new iPhone when it comes out. I deserve the car at 16. And so if you can break that arrogance about it and teach your kids humility. I love C.S. Lewis's quote. He says, humility is not thinking less of yourself, but it's thinking of yourself less. Uh-huh. And so by teaching your kids to give, and that's such a crucial part of money, teaching your kids to live with an open hand and to be grateful, all of that breeds contentment. And when you're content, it's hard to be entitled. And so that's kind of an emotional side of money, but one that's key. And I think exactly what you said about the car, I think that is such a good thing. My parents, they matched us. Whatever money we saved, they would match it. Dad called that his 401 Dave plan. 401 Dave, yeah. And you're, what they said, that was my story. I mean, I remember getting in that car and those weekends that I didn't go to the mall or go to the pool, that I was working, so much time went into this car, and I drove it much differently than my friends that were given cars. And so, just like you said, that emotional experience, you appreciate things when you sacrifice for it. And so letting your kids feel that, so whether it's a little Lego set because maybe they're 6 or 7 years old, or maybe they're 16 and it's their car, but let them save up and pay for things, because part of that is learning patience and learning delayed gratification and this pride of, I worked for this. And when you have those emotions, it feels so good, and you're teaching your kids that they can do it and they have the dignity to be able to go and complete tasks and do it versus just handing them everything, because that's where the entitlement comes in. And parents' heart, I think, with this millennial generation, because I'm part of it, I think I'm in the smack middle of it, I think parents' hearts are so good in it. They want their kids to have a better life than they did, but they're harming their kids. Because what happens is they graduate, and you know, you want the same kind of car as your parents, go on the same kind of vacations as your parents, live in the same kind of house as your parents. You know, you suddenly want exactly what your parents have because they've been giving you a lot of that lifestyle early on in life. And Larry Perkett says, he said, we spend the first 5 to 7 years of our marriages trying to obtain the same standard of living as our parents, but it took our parents 30 years to get there.
Right.
And so that's what's tough, and that's kind of the uphill battle that parents are fighting today.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I mean, there's a lot to consume in terms of you know, how to teach our kids, obviously, and it's not easy because they'll battle us. You know, they'll battle us along the way. I mean, it's not like it says, okay, we're going to do this, okay, and they're going to just go along with it and be happy about it and just deal with it. You know, and obviously with some of the things that we're seeing out there with the incredible amount of college debt, and now there's some discussion about, you know, extension of that and actually having some of that forgiven. Again, back to the entitlement issue, there's some laws that are coming into play here now. I have one question for you that is always I just don't get. And that is about, well, when I was young, because I'm giving you the differential between what's going on then and now, we had two different kinds of cards that I remember. One was a charge card, and one was a credit card. A charge card was great. It was, like, awesome, because you charge stuff now, and I don't really have to pay for it for 1 month. That's it. You had to pay for it at the end, right? You couldn't roll it. That was the old American Express concept. That was a charge card. Yeah. A lot of department stores had charge cards. You had to pay it. Then they came out with the credit cards and all that. But one of the things that I find just fascinating is that it's still allowed that these credit card companies can charge 18 to 20% plus on a regular basis for money. Is there ever going to be something that changes about that? Because it seems to me that that's where one of the biggest issues, because once you get wrapped up in that process of buying on credit cards and assuming or thinking that you can pay the minimum, I think that you agree with me that if you have, let's just take a number, $5,000 on a credit card that's a 20% credit card, okay, and you pay the minimums, you'll never pay it off, ever. So what do we do about that?
Yeah, well, I don't mean credit card companies. There's not much that we can do to control them, obviously, unless you know the government puts something in place that maxes out, you know, limits it. But it is. It's a nasty process, and it's a nasty thing that people get wrapped up in because, like you said, they have good intentions of this idea that I can pay it back. I can, you know, or I can at least make the minimum payment. And what happens is you kind of live crisis to crisis because what if a job is lost? You know, what if your income stops coming in? I mean, and so that's why I tell people all the time, and what I truly believe is do not get a credit card. Pay it off, and people do pay it off, you know, even if their balance is $5,000 and their interest rate is crazy. I mean, you know, sell so much stuff the kids sink their necks. I mean, you know, go crazy to pay this off. We've talked to literally millions of people that have paid off crazy amounts of debt, even though the interest rate is fighting back, which is frustrating and hard, and they look back and they wish they could do things differently. But one thing, you know, for parents to give the gift to your kids is to show them and teach them you can live life without a credit card. I've never had a credit card. Hmm. I have a debit card that's attached to my bank account, but I have never had a credit card. And because of that, I think I spend money differently. When you spend your own money, it's emotional. You feel it much differently if you're spending, you know, versus spending the bank's money. And it does so good because I don't have to worry about those debt collectors. I don't have to worry about the credit card. And I have to say no to myself a lot. I would love to go on a shopping spree with $5,000. There are times I'm like, oh, that'd be nice to have. But so I have to say no to myself. But that's a sign of maturity.
Right.
A sign of maturity is adults devise a plan and follow it. Children do what feels good. And so you can't live your life that way. And that's where I think that people get in trouble with the credit card for sure.
I hear you. Rachel Cruz, author of Smart Money, Smart Kids, and speaker and educator all about getting rid of that darn debt and getting rid of the credit cards and living your life in a way not only of fulfillment financially but also of giving. I know you do a lot of work in that area as well in terms of, you know, once you have some money and all that, you can actually help out others that actually helps you too. It's a big vicious cycle, which a good one though. I mean, I'm talking about a good one that just, you know, it's a virtual cycle that once you get to a point that you can have fulfillment. I'm probably speaking all the things that you would speak about, but you know that I'm getting this from all your information. I mean, I think it's a beautiful thing. Awesome.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly right. You want to be able to win with money, not just to change your own family tree, but also help others.
Yep, I think it's great. Hey, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on.
Right.
Thank you
all
so much.
Thanks. Bye bye. Well, we covered a lot of space today, a lot of area. We went all the way from net neutrality and how possibly there's going to be this standoff between the providers and maybe going all the way up to the infrastructure developers, you know, the Ciscos and then the IP and, you know, companies that provide the actual flow down to the Netflix / distributions, maybe ISPs, all the way to us. We'll see how that plays out in the news. And we also had some great conversation with Rachel Cruz there. That was awesome. If you want to get in touch with me, just send an email to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can also find all the information on this episode, including the links to Rachel's book over at the show notes on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next week. We have some special guests. Alan Krueger, former White House chief of economist, is going to be on next week. And we're looking forward to a pretty jam-packed summer of guests. So make sure to tune in, subscribe, go over to iTunes, go over to the site, RSS feed, wherever you go, wherever you get it. And look forward to talking to you then. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company. a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.